Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And happy Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, whatever it may be. And Chris, boy, have I got an echo in my earphones. Greetings, my friends. Thank you, Chris. Tom Hartman here broadcasting in live from Portland, Oregon, and on this beautiful Friday. And we're going to have Paul Krugman with us in the second hour of our program. We're going to be talking about the politics, Hillary Clinton, what's going on in the world of politics in general, particularly Democratic politics, in our third hour. And, of course, anything goes Friday, any of the topics you want to bring up. But, as always, in our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, neither a Democrat nor a Republican. I think of him as America's senator. His website, sanders.senate.gov. A lot of great information there. You can sign up for his newsletter. And Senator Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie hour. Bernie will be taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. What's on your list?
It has been a busy and, as usual, chaotic week here in the Congress. A lot of issues are taking place. Yesterday I spent several hours at a markup writing legislation on global warming. The bottom line there is that the bill made some progress but did not go anywhere near as far as it had to go in order to address what scientists are telling us is just a catastrophe waiting to happen if we do not act boldly. So the good news is Congress is beginning to reverse direction that Bush has taken us, which is essentially to ignore the very dangerous trends in global warming in terms of droughts, in terms of forest fires, in terms of the melting of the glaciers of the polar caps, et cetera, et cetera. But it remains to be seen whether Congress is really going to stand up, break our dependency on fossil fuels, substantially lower greenhouse gas emissions. What the scientists tell us, we got a 50-50 chance to prevent catastrophe if we lower greenhouse gas emissions by 80% in the year 2050. The legislation that came out of committee yesterday was at 63% at best, certainly not enough, which is why I voted against it. Other provisions in it certainly were not good. And we got a lot of work in front of us.
Yeah, and in the news this morning, the state of Tabasco in Mexico, which is no small state, 700,000, basically the entire state now is flooded, 700,000 people displaced. It's mind-boggling. Add to that the fires in Southern California.
Add to that.
This is just in our hemisphere.
Add to that that in Georgia right now they're experiencing, and some of the other southern states, the worst drought in memory. Georgia is literally running out of water within, a couple of months. I mean, we face a huge problem, and that's the bad news, and that's certainly equally bad news is we have a president who has essentially denied the problem for years and has not done anything significant to address it. The good news, the really good news, is that we know how to reverse global warming and to lower carbon emissions, and what's central there is moving aggressively in terms of energy efficiency in our homes, offices, factories, in transportation. We know that we need a major rail system in this country that can compete with Europe, compete with Japan, even with China. We have a rail system now which is totally antiquated. And if we have a decent rail system, we can get people out of their cars, get them to work on a train. We know that it is totally insane that we are driving cars that on average get worse mileage per gallon than was the case 20 years ago when we have the potential to significantly increase our CAFE standards and the mileage that our cars are getting. So energy efficiency is huge. Right now, Tom, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, but right now in Nevada, there is a solar power plant which is online producing electricity. There is a plan that within a couple of years, an Israeli company is going to be building a plant for Pacific Gas and Electric that will provide over 500 megawatts of electricity for 400,000 homes through solar energy. And there is no reason why we can't significantly expand that. And as we expand it, the price goes down. It becomes quite competitive. So you're looking at the potential of solar. You're looking at the potential of wind. You're looking at geothermal. It's all sitting there. Meanwhile, in this particular bill, over $300 billion was kind of guaranteed for so-called clean coal, which is a dubious technology. Money was being given to the automobile industry, which has resisted us day after day in terms of raising CAFE standards. So this is the beginning of the legislative process. We've got a long way to go. But my goal is to see us move very boldly in terms of energy efficiency, sustainable energy, and in the process, what is not talked about enough, we can create millions of good-paying jobs transforming our energy system, and that's a goal that's worth fighting for.
Yeah. I find it amazing, just as a kind of anecdotal side note to this, that as a consequence of largely 26 years, but mostly the last 15 years or so of insane international trade policies, that we are so in debt in terms of our balance of payments deficit that we've got all these very innovative projects being done. There's a big one being done, they're talking about being done here in Oregon off the coast using wave power by a Spanish company.
That's right.
An Israeli company in Nevada. Where are the American companies?
You got it.
We just don't have the money.
Well, it's not only we don't have the money. In Spain, they're giving very strong support to the solar industry. In this country, you're right, that a Spanish and an Israeli company are building power plants in the United States because where are the General Electrics and so forth? And the answer is we have given huge support to fossil fuels. We have given huge support to nuclear power. We have given very little support to sustainable energies, which have just incredible potential to reverse global warming.
Yeah, when Jimmy Carter was, you know, put into place tax breaks and subsidies and things, I mean, we had a solar industry that was really beginning to emerge here in the United States in the late 70s that was entirely domestic and homegrown, and it just, you know, Reagan killed it.
Right, and we have not yet recovered, and that's what the fight is on right here, and we're going to do our best to make sure that this country once again becomes a leader in those areas. Now, there's another issue. The farm bill, we think, is going to be coming up perhaps next week. And one of the areas that I'm going to be kind of focusing on is the disgrace that in this country, the richest country in the history of the world, the United States Department of Agriculture reported last year that 12% of Americans, that's 35 million people, could not put food on the table at least part of the year. In other words, they were hungry. This is America. And this is just indicative of the growing gap between the rich and the poor. People on top have never had it so good. But when you get way down the food chain, so to speak, you're having people in this country who are struggling literally to put food on their table. We're going to fight for increased nutrition programs, and we're going to bring forth a resolution which demands that the United States government within 5 years wipes out hunger in America.
Yeah, good, good. That's great. What else is on your...
Well,
your
Mr. Mukasey is coming
up.
Oh,
yes. Yes, how can we...
And there's a lot of politics going on there. Not quite sure what's going to happen. Last week, I believe I was the first member of the Senate to say no to Mukasey, not only with regard to this waterboarding issue, and he doesn't know whether that's torture or not, but more importantly, in his answers to the Judiciary Committee, he was really very vague in terms of what he believes the power of the president to be. Bush, of course, argues that when we're at war with terrorism, and for Bush, this is a never-ending war, it will go on for the foreseeable future. The president, more or less, has kind of unlimited power in terms of tapping people's phones, investigating people. You don't have to go to an independent judiciary. You don't have to get warrants. And I think we need an attorney general who will explain to the president of the United States something that he obviously does not know, and that is what the Constitution of this country is about. So that's an issue that certainly will be on the front page.
Isn't Bush kind of caught in a catch-22, though? If he sends up somebody who acknowledges that waterboarding is torture, that person then becoming the chief law enforcement officer of the United States would have at least a moral, if not a legal obligation to begin prosecuting members of
Bush's
own administration.
Well, that's one problem. But the other problem is that if you had an attorney general who was clear about what the Constitution was about, that attorney general would be advising the president that he could not do many of the things that this president believes that he
should. I'm totally opposed to Mukasey, and I totally agree with you. I can't imagine that Bush is going to send up ultimately anybody who's going to, well, we'll see, I guess.
Well, and you know, what we're, and furthermore, I mean, what's going on down here is there are bills that are going before the president, the so-called S-CHIP bill, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, designed to increase funding for health insurance for 4 million more kids. President Bush says, well, yeah, I do have $10 billion a month for the war in Iraq. No problem. Tax breaks for billionaires. We just can't afford to provide health insurance to lower-income kids.
Yeah, it's a crime. It's absolutely a crime.
So that's also an issue taking place right now.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, 866-303-2270. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, our website, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
21 minutes past the hour, just a couple of heads up here. I'm heading out this afternoon to Albuquerque, where tomorrow I will be keynoting the Holistic Management International Conference. You can get information about that at holisticmanagement.org. And that'll be, I think it's around 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock. Anyhow, it's in the mid-afternoon. And then at 5 o'clock, I'll be signing my new book, Cracking the Code, at Hastings Books and Musics in Albuquerque. On Monday, on the 5th, November 5th, Powell's Bookstore here in Portland. Next Friday, the 9th, a week from tonight, in Phoenix, KPHX, the Harkins Theater in downtown in Arizona Mills in Tempe from 3 to 5 p.m. They're selling tickets for that event, and you have to go to 1480kphx.com for those. And also next Thursday, November 8th, on the show, on the second hour of our program, we're going to have both sides of the 9/11 truth debate. I'm going to get out of the way. I don't claim to be an expert on any of this, on either side of this. And we're going to have Kevin Ryan, the co-founder of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and Michael Shermer from Skeptic Magazine, debating all the various aspects of what may have or may not have happened on 9/11. I think it's going to be a fascinating program. That'll be next Thursday. Right now, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us this entire hour, taking your calls. And Bernie, anything you want to add, or should we just start taking calls here?
Let's do it.
Okay, Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on KKZN. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator, thank you so very much for opposing Mukasey. I was an intelligence officer in Vietnam, and the first thing I'd like you to do is to please ask Senator Chuck Hagel about the Geneva Convention card that he and his brother carried in Vietnam. When I was there, waterboarding was torture. It was a war crime in violation of the Geneva Convention, and it was a court-martial offense. Now our troops, when they take prisoners, know that torture is waterboarding. Yet they're supposed to be Sergeant Schultz and hand their prisoners over to the CIA or mercenaries for waterboarding versus unilateral shock or worse. We're putting our troops in one hell of a position, sir. Thank you for opposing Mukasey. Please give our troops clear guidance. Thank you.
Well, Ralph, thank you very much. Thank you for your service to the country. Ralph raises a number of issues, and I agree with him. In addition, one of the great concerns that I think millions of Americans have is the continued lowering of respect all over this world that people have for the United States. You know, Tom, we should never ever forget that it wasn't so many years ago that when an American president went to Europe or went abroad, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people would come out and wave flags and look at the United States as a model of where they wanted their countries to go.
And that president needed no security for all practical purposes.
Right.
I mean, John Kennedy used to wade out into crowds.
Right. And now, you know, when people come out, when Bush goes abroad, it's to protest him. And this is bad for so many reasons, not least of which it is very hard to put together the kind of coalitions we need to fight international terrorism if governments around the world don't want to work with the United States because we have a president who is so unpopular. And in addition to that, and certainly torture is one of the reasons. How do we talk about freedom, human dignity, when all over the world people perceive that we are engaging in torture? And furthermore, we endanger our own troops, because if our troops are captured, you know, what do we have to say if they are tortured, if we are doing the same to other people? So, you know, Ralph is absolutely right, and my hope is that Mukasey will be defeated.
Amen. Gene in Napa, California, listening on K-Green. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
To follow the last questioner, I was wondering if the legislature is doing anything to restore habeas corpus. I consider habeas corpus a psychological torture to people as just like physical torture, and both are forbidden by the Geneva Conventions. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, habeas corpus is protected, you know, by our own laws and our own Constitution. And the answer is yes. I know the Judiciary Committee has held hearings on this issue. And if I have anything to say to it, we will make it very clear that habeas corpus is an essential right of not just what America is about, it's what we have seen in democratic countries for hundreds and hundreds of years, and that is people have certain basic rights to know that they're not going to be squirreled away and put in detention camps or in jail without the ability to contact their attorney. So the answer to the question is yes, there is action on that.
Bernie, we just have about 20 seconds before I have to take a break. A quick one. The Military Commissions Act creates a third system of justice in the United States that never before existed. Any chance that that's going to be rolled back?
Well, I think there are. I'm not on the Judiciary Committee, but I think that both Senator Leahy and Congressman John Conyers are taking a hard look at all of Bush's attacks on our constitutional rights, including the Military Commissions Act.
No, good. Because it just, that seems so onerous that the president has the right now to declare anybody, you or me, an enemy combatant, and instantly we lose virtually all rights and we're tried in the military system, not in the domestic system, but a third one.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're absolutely right. It's a huge issue. We've got to deal with it.
Indeed. 27 minutes past the hour, we're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website. Our number, 866-303-2270. AirAmerica.com, TomHartman.com. More information on the show and to drop into our live chat room 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, we've got truth right here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, unscreened, unscripted, from our listeners, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Rich in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. It's Bernie. Hey, I just wanted to see if they were going to let the president get away with another veto of the SCIP bill, because I think he's a little out of touch when he thinks that we can just go to the emergency room without insurance, because last time I went to the emergency room, we got an $1,800 bill from that.
So that $1,800?
Yeah, he must think the emergency room was free, that we can just go run to the emergency room.
You know, it is amazing when you stop and think of it. Rich, we got 47 million Americans who have no health insurance, and that number has gone up by some 6 million since Bush has been in office. The cost of health care is soaring. We spend twice as much per person on health care as any other nation. Do you ever hear this president talking about health care? No ideas. No ideas whatsoever. He is deeply indebted to the insurance companies and to the pharmaceutical industry and has been extraordinarily callous in terms of the health care needs of the American people. We are going to continue to fight for SCHIP. We have the votes to override a veto here in the Senate. They don't have the votes in the House. I know a lot of pressure is being put on those Republicans who continue to support the president on this issue. The president says two things. He says, oh my goodness, we can't afford to spend $7 billion a year more for 5 years for health insurance for 4 million kids. Just can't do it. Meanwhile, we spend $10 billion a month on the war in Iraq, and he hasn't a clue as to how that's going to be paid for. That's just emergency funding. Just adding.
Yeah, this
to the
is really not about money, Bernie. It's really about ideology, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
The second point
I was going to make is the president is very worried that the private insurance companies may lose some business, and he has a kind of a moral obligation to support the large private insurance companies. So I can tell you that in the state of Vermont, we have a program called the Dr. Dinosaur Programs. A program. Other states have different programs, different names. Same thing. These programs work very, very well. I don't believe I have talked to a parent in the state of Vermont who does not think Dr. Dinosaur is working for his or her kids. So we have got to expand the program. And let me just mention to you, Tom, there are 9 million kids in this country without health insurance. This would simply expand it to another 4 million. In my view, we should be covering at the very least, every kid in America. But bottom line here, in terms of Rich's question, we have a healthcare system that is out of control, that is disintegrating. We are the only nation in the industrialized world that does not provide health care to all people as a right. I am working along with other members of the Senate on various concepts to move this country toward a national health care program, which could be much more cost-effective, provide care to everybody. And that's the direction we've got to go.
Yeah. At the suggestion of a listener, Bernie, I've got a new comeback line for when these conservatives say to me, oh, everybody has health care. Anybody can go into an emergency room. I'm going to start saying, good, then will you please commit right now to drop your health insurance policy since you, too, can go to an emergency room and just see what they say.
The answer is Rich just indicated, you can go into an emergency room. He came out with a bill of $1,800. The absurdity of forcing people to get their health care through an emergency room is absurd because it is incredibly expensive. Second of all, what you need to do is make sure that people have access on a regular basis to a physician, not just emergency care. And one of the reasons that we want to provide health insurance to every kid in this country is forget the pain and suffering. Just from a financial point of view, how can you let kids' illnesses go undiagnosed so that 10 years later they become serious problems and the kid ends up in the hospital? It makes zero sense at all.
Yeah, well, agreed. Marty in Los Angeles, California, you're on the air with listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator Sanders. Hillary Clinton just seems to impress me as someone that's impress is the right word, very disingenuous. Most immediately, as was brought up at the debates, her support of the Kyle Lieberman Amendment and the acceptance of big money, lobbying money, a lot of the same people that have given money to George Bush, Harkin Oil, et cetera. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well,
I know she's one of...
She's, right, she sits next to me on the Health, Education, and Labor Committee. You know, what we have to take and what we really have got to do is take a very hard look at how we fund campaigns. I myself, running for the Senate, I don't take corporate PAC money. That's just the way it is. But if you have to raise the kinds of sums of money that these candidates raise, they spend half their lives raising money and they have to go to people that they should not have to go to for money. And it seems to me that we are not going to have the kind of progressive changes we need in this country, that it's a national health care program, asking the wealthy and large corporations to pay their fair share of taxes, serious environmental legislation, unless we move toward public funding of elections. Because so long as candidates are dependent upon money from the drug companies, from the insurance companies, from the coal companies, from the oil companies, they are in many ways not going to do the right thing by the American people. So this is not just a problem for Hillary Clinton. It's a problem for candidates running for president, running for Senate, running for the House, running for governor. We need radical changes in campaign financing in this country.
Yeah, I think this is one of the reasons why John Edwards and Barack Obama are not taking money from the lobbyists and the PACs, and you know, good on them at least for doing it. Doug in the Bronx, New York, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hello. Okay, thank you, Senator Sanders. In the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, I don't remember which section it is, does it not say that the Congress can make laws concerning captures on land and sea in time of war? In other words, the Congress is in charge of prisoners in time of war or anybody that's deemed an enemy combatant in this case.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that 535 members of the Congress are going to be running detention camps.
No, I don't say run it. I mean, they can make laws about it. It says in the Constitution that that area is in the legislative branch area, not in the executive branch, doesn't it?
Well, the Congress has the right to pass any bill it wants to pass. If that's your question, absolutely right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, here's it's Section 8, Paragraph 11. Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water.
So the answer is yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mark in Los Angeles, did you want to continue on that, Bernie? Or?
Well, only that if Doug's question is regarding how we treat prisoners, should Congress do the right thing on that? The answer is absolutely. We should make it clear that it is not the policy of the United States military to engage in torture. period.
Yeah. Mark in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. I'd like to know, regarding Mukasey, if anyone asked him, not about the waterboarding issue per se, but about the constitutional illegality of ignoring of the Geneva Conventions, and if so, then what was his response? Because as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather have no head of what this is basically amounting to, an injustice department, and I don't wish any more of this lame duck president to go forward, because any further cooperation with his process is appeasement. We need to impeach him and not appease him the way we have.
Well, Mark, as I indicated, I was the first member of the Senate to say that I would vote against Mukasey, and I believe we need an attorney general who will be very clear about his understanding of the Constitution and make it clear that he will tell the President of the United States that it is not acceptable to continue to engage in illegal and unconstitutional activities.
Joe in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I want to first state that I agree a lot of what Senator's saying about the environmental issue. I really think that it's an important aspect of politics that we need to deal with right now. Not necessarily. Well, anyway, let me get to my question. My question is, why is it that nobody wants to bring up the whole hemp for fuel thing, about how clean it could be and how easy it is to mass produce and how freely it is to, you know, just grow? You don't have to fight wars over it or nothing like that. And I think
like in the Middle East. So, Bernie, Canada has now legalized growing hemp, and in fact, it's a major industry up there. It's a good source of diesel fuel.
It's a source of what, Tom? I'm sorry.
Diesel fuel. It's a great source of oil.
Hemp is now a source of diesel fuel in Canada.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, very good. Well, I mean, I think this is an issue that we should look at. Obviously, the concern here has been the relationship between that and marijuana. But hemp has historically been a very important crop in this country in a for a number of products, and I certainly have no objection to taking a hard look at that.
Yeah, I mean, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are written on hemp paper.
Is that right?
It's true. Doug in San Diego, California, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Great. Good morning, Senator Sanders. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Doug. How are you?
I got a great question for you. Well, a couple. First, do you support government funding to build desalination plants on both coast to get us more potable water, and are you against photo ID to vote? And if you are against photo ID to vote, how do you prove you're a U.S. citizen with a utility bill?
Okay, well, let me start with the second question, which I have more familiarity with. Our Republican friends, despite all of the evidence, are going around saying they're just terribly worrying about voter fraud and that all of these people are voting who should not be voting. There seems to be no evidence for that at all. What these voter IDs cards, government cards, are is an effort, in my view, to make sure that lower-income people, that senior citizens, don't get the opportunity to vote. It's a reverse poll tax effort. I am very strongly against it. I want to see as many people vote in this country as possible. If people are voting fraudulently, they should be punished.
We'll pick that up on the other side of this break.
Okay.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. You feel bad, but not bad enough. You know you had it coming because you played so rough. Back over your shoulder, got an icy chill. And you thought you'd get away with it. Now you know you never will.
The world is figuring out what George Bush is up to. 9.5 minutes before the hour, it's our brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website.
Let's revisit that question.
Yes,
that
sir.
Just came up, right? Two parts of it. Let me reiterate. I believe that in a democratic society, we've got to do everything we can to expand voter turnout. We have millions of Americans in this country who, for a variety of reasons, do not vote. Many of them are lower-income people. What the Republican Party has been trying to do in recent years is do everything they can to limit voter turnout. They don't want lower-income people and working people to vote. They prefer.
Bernie, if I may, just for a moment, punctuate what you're saying with a 20-second quote from Paul Weyrich. I think you've heard this before, but many of our listeners may not have. May I play a clip here?
Sure, please.
Okay, this is Paul Weyrich, one of the senior Republican strategists, helped bring Reagan to power. This was about 15 years ago. He was speaking to a group of Republican activists in a church.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
That's the bottom line.
Thank you, Paul Weyrich. You made my point perfectly. They want small voter turnouts. They want the upper class to vote, the upper middle class to vote. They certainly don't want working people and poor people to vote. Many ways you do it. They have focused on intimidating African Americans from voting. They did that in Florida in 2000. We know big time. So the idea of a photo ID is, well, I have a photo ID, driver's license. I have a car. Millions of people in this country do not have a car. So this can be a very difficult process to get a government ID. You have to pay a certain sum of money to do it. A lot of people won't do it. So this is an effort to discourage people from voting. In terms of the desalinization part of his question, I'll tell you this. This country today is now beginning to deal with a very, very serious problem of water. It's going to be an international problem. It has a lot to do with global warming. Georgia, right now, just yesterday, there was a meeting in the White House. Governors of a number of states dealing very serious problems in the South, especially Georgia, major drought. California, states in the West are sitting here right now figuring out how they're going to get the necessary water they need in 10, 15, 20 years. So I think we've got to look at all options. I don't know enough about the cost of desalinization, but I can tell you making sure that we have drinkable water in this country and throughout the world is going to be right on the top of a lot of people's agenda.
Amen. Philip in Pine Brook, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Philip?
My question is just regarding the 800 or so signing statements that Bush has put forth in, over the years. Would it be possible when a new administration comes in for Congress to pass a single omnibus bill that nullifies all of those 800 signing statements in one fell swoop rather than having to go through each bill, which would take years? Or is it possible for the president by executive order to nullify them?
Well, folks, you're raising a good question, and I don't know the answer, but I do know these signing statements are an outrage. And if people don't know what that is, that means that the president says, yeah, I'm going to sign the bill, but by the way, we don't support provision number 387, and I'm not going to enforce that. So he picks and chooses what he wants to enforce. That is not what the law is about. It's not what the Constitution is about. The president wants to veto a bill. He has that right. He can't pick and choose the provisions in that. And I am actually still thinking about ways, along with other members of the Senate, to address that issue. But this is, again, a great usurpation on the part of the president of congressional authority, and it has to be dealt with in one way or the other. You raise some ideas. There may be some other ideas out there, but it certainly has to be dealt with.
Debbie in Tijeras, New Mexico. Is that? Am I pronouncing that right, Debbie?
Yes, Tijeras.
Tijeras, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom and Senator Sanders. I would like Senator Sanders to please comment on the fact that Bush, according to Wednesday's Washington Post, will, quote, turn to administrative orders to implement policy. Is he not essentially claiming by doing so that he has the right to define laws that he'll follow on his own without any input from the legislative branch?
That'd be a very good question. There was an article in the Washington Post which I think said that Bush intends to because he no longer has Republicans controlling the House and the Senate and he can't get his way, what he's going to try to do as much as he can by presidential authority, by executive order, by not having to go to the Congress. The president has, you know, essentially gone to war against Congress. He's vetoing, has vetoed, is threatening to veto major pieces of legislation, which protect the needs of our children, protect the needs of our own veterans, protect the environment, and so forth and so on. And remember, let's never forget, this is a guy, Tom, who came in when he campaigned. He says he is a uniter, not a divider.
Right.
And now what Debbie is saying, quite right, is he's like, well, gee, I don't have support in the House and the Senate. Hey, I'll forget about those guys. I think we just have to be very mindful of what he is doing and make sure that we use congressional authority to stop those actions that are not good for the country.
Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. We have about a minute left before we have to wrap up the hour. You're on the air. Sheila?
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm there. Quick question then. I'm very concerned that with all the spying going on, that they're going to be spying on the Democrats as they campaign. And how can they keep their strategy secret?
Well, I'm sure that high-level political people know how to protect their own interests. But the issue of spying raises the whole issue of this FISA bill. The American people have a right to know that when they get on the telephone or they use their email, that they are not being spied upon by the United States government. This is an issue that will be on the floor of the Senate very shortly. I will do what I can to protect the privacy, not only of political candidates, but of all Americans.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, the website, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great.
Thank you.
Having you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. 57 minutes past the hour. Paul Krugman coming up next. Stick around.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Let's talk politics and economics here for a while. The intersection of the two. It has always seemed to me that economics is really the driver of politics. And so often it gets ignored. In fact, people want to talk about guns, gays, and God, abortion and whatnot. And really, the driving force behind so much of what we call politics, all the way back to the founding of this country, has been economic. Paul Krugman is with us. He is the professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, a professor at the London School of Economics, nationally syndicated op-ed columnist, named Columnist of the Year by Editor and Publisher Magazine for his column in the New York Times, which he writes twice a week. He's the winner of the John Bates Clark Medal, the most prized award given to American economists. And as I mentioned, teaches economics and international affairs at Princeton University. Paul Krugman, welcome back to our program. It's been a couple of years since we've talked. It's great to have you back with us.
Good to be on.
Thank you. First of all, you have a new book out, The Conscience of a Liberal, and I want to congratulate you. It's brilliant. I haven't finished reading it yet, but I'm well into it, and a great, well grounded in history, certainly, in particular from the New Deal forward, and the whole history of movement conservatism and just some remarkable stuff that I'd like to get into in our conversation this afternoon. We're going to have an opportunity to have a little bit of an in-depth talk. First, though, I'm curious what your take is on what happened yesterday with the Fed. It seems that Bernanke is in a corner. If he raises interest rates, he throws the economy into recession. If he lowers the interest rates, he crashes the dollar further and leads to hyperinflation. Are we at a point similar to what we were in the 80s when the bill came due for the Vietnam War, that the bill is coming due now for the Iraq War and we're going to see something like stagflation?
Okay, I'm a little less apocalyptic than that. I hate to disappoint you, but...
That's okay.
Iraq is an outrage. It's incredible. The things we could have done with the money are the children's health bill that Bush has vetoed for 5 years for 4 million children would have cost 41 days in Iraq. So it's an outrageous waste, and we are now talking probably at least $2 trillion spent in Iraq by the time all is said and done. The U.S. is a very, very big economy. And so a trillion here, a trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money. But still,
to paraphrase Everett Dirksen, yeah.
It's not it, even the way I like to put it is as a share of the economy, Iraq is still running at around one-tenth of what the Cold War cost. It's running at about a half of what Vietnam cost. So it's not a crippling expense. It's an outrageous expense, but it's not crippling. The economic...
But it adds to everything else. I mean,
it adds to everything else. Now, it's... Tell you, the falling dollar does not worry me. It adds a little bit to inflation, but it actually helps U.S. exports. The fallout from the housing, the bursting of the housing bubble and the subprime stuff, that's where it's really scary, because we don't know how deep that rabbit hole goes, and it could be a really big problem.
What's the significance of this injection of $41 billion into the economy yesterday?
Oh, it's just a question of... we're having what amounts to a slow motion non-bank bank run. people are confident in their bank deposits, but they're not confident in stuff that looks a lot like bank deposits, mostly institutional investors. So short-term loans to hedge fund operated, stuff. And you have the real problem of what amounts to a kind of a run where people are afraid to lend short term because they're not sure they could trust the guy on the other end of the transaction. And so the Fed is pumping money into the economy in an attempt to, keep people, you know, keep the juices flowing. It's very awkward, might not work if it gets really serious, but, I think the answer shortly, in short is stay tuned. More likely than not, it's not crippling, but the odds of something really bad are high enough to make us all a little bit sleepless at night.
Well, isn't a liquidity crisis just a fancy way of saying that's what happened in 1929, 1930?
1931, actually. What we're really 31. Worried about is the stock market crash was just the beginning, and the banking crisis of 1930-31 is what really caused the Great Depression. And
that was a liquidity crisis.
Liquidity crisis. Basically, everybody couldn't trust banks. Banks were being run. People put their cash under the mattress, and the surviving banks locked it all up in the vaults and refused to lend it out. And now, we have a nice, this actually does tie in with the themes of conscience of liberal, because we dealt with all of that by creating a set of prudential regulations, government guarantees for the banking system. And all that's great, except now we've had basically the growth of an unregulated financial system that doesn't end run around traditional banking. And although there were warnings, people told members of the Federal Reserve Board told Alan Greenspan, hey, we got a problem developing here. He said, don't worry, markets will take care of themselves. And here we are.
Well, yeah, and that probably is in large part, it can be tracked right back to 1956 when he sat in Ayn Rand's apartment and was initiated into her cult of objectivism.
You really got a... amazing amount of damage some bad novels have managed to do to America.
Yeah, it's really quite incredible. In fact, today's Financial Times, an article about a major U.S. real estate appraisal company was accused yesterday of conspiring with one of the nation's biggest banks to inflate home prices in a scheme the New York State officials say helped fuel the mortgage crisis. Again, to your book, The Conscience of a Liberal, in the book, you make a strong argument for capitalism in a regulated environment as opposed to laissez-faire capitalism. Isn't this a perfect example of how Greenspan and Reagan and Bush, this whole idea of just leave everything to the corporate powers that be, to the mythical invisible hand that Adam Smith actually only mentioned once in Wealth of Nations?
Right, and in fact, elsewhere in Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith said, you know, a group of businessmen rarely get together without trying to hatch some conspiracy to defraud the market. So if you actually read Adam Smith, he ain't leading you where they think he does. But yeah, whenever you have a large financial bubble, which we had on housing and mortgage lending, it turns out that there's a fair bit of fraud involved. And what we've actually got here is what looks like double-edged fraud. A lot of the least sophisticated, lower-income borrowers were misled into taking mortgages that they really couldn't afford. And at the same time, those mortgages were then repackaged into financial instruments that were sold to investors who didn't understand what they were getting. So what do you get when you cross an investment banker with a godfather, somebody makes you an offer you can't understand?
and that's exactly what's happened, tragically.
Yeah.
In Conscience of a Liberal, you talk about the Great Compression. Explain to our listeners what the Great Compression
is. Things you don't get taught in high school. middle-class America, for about 30 years after World War II, we had a genuinely middle-class society. Had lots of flaws, had a lot of poor people, but most people were living in a truly middle-class way, and there was a lot of fundamental equality in America. That didn't just happen. It wasn't something that were just, you know, the market changed it was created. It was created by Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. It was created in a very short period of time, between 1935 and 1945. And that's the Great Compression. Not my phrase, but what the economic historians call it. Social Security, unemployment insurance, progressive taxation, minimum wages, labor laws that gave unions a chance to organize, all of those things enhanced the bargaining power of working Americans. Let them get a much, much better standard of living. Let hurt people who were very rich. People who called FDR a class traitor were right. He was making people of his class worse off, but made most Americans much better off and created a society which had a lot of common ground. It was an economic democracy in a way that it hadn't been before and isn't now.
Indeed. And I wrote an op-ed about a year ago suggesting that we should forget about trying to roll back the Bush tax cuts. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Your thoughts on that?
Well, even a fair bit. I mean, we can talk about exactly how it needs to be done. But, yeah, we need, first off, rolling back the Bush tax cuts is enough to pay for a basic universal health care scheme, which is the first and most essential step. Going further on down the line, child poverty is vastly higher in the United States than it is in any other advanced country. And the reason for that is primarily that we don't provide enough support to families with children. The sheer amount of misery going beyond health care that Americans can fall into is much greater than a rich country has any right to have. What does all that cost? It costs 2 or 3% of GDP, and that means more taxes.
Yeah, so we'll get into that in more detail right after the break. And that's the social safety net side of it. I mean, there's also the minimum wage side of it, and the unionization side of it. We're talking with Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, economist, professor of economics. His new book, The Conscience of a Liberal, krugman.blogs.nytimes.com is his blog, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Just a quick heads up for our listeners in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'll be the keynote speaker at the Holistic Management International Conference there tomorrow, holisticmanagement.org, and we'll be signing Cracking the Code, my new book, at Hastings Books and Music in Albuquerque at 5 p.m. on the 3rd. On the 5th, Powell's Bookstore here in Portland. On the 9th, Harkins Theater in Tempe, Arizona. Tickets on sale for that. Speech I'll be giving and book signing, 1480kphx.com, our Phoenix affiliate, and more. More will be coming. We'll be at the Strand in New York, et cetera, et cetera. And Paul Krugman's also on book tour right now. He's got a new book out. In fact, he'll also be in my hometown, Portland, Oregon, tomorrow night, won't you, sir?
Yes, indeed, I will.
I
think it's the Baghdad Theater.
Yeah, you're going to be at the Baghdad Theater. Yeah, that should be a hoot. The book, The Conscience of a Liberal. Paul Krugman, in your book, you talk about movement conservatism and the rise of movement conservatism. And there's an astounding quote from 1957 from the National Review. And a tip of the hat, by the way, to Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show here on KPOJ, who brought this up this morning. In this quote, they say the central question that emerges is whether the white community in the South, now this is how the conservatives used to talk to each other, is whether the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally in areas where it does not predominate numerically. The sobering answer is yes, the white community is so entitled because, for the time being, it is the advanced race. National Review believes that the South's premises are correct.
It is more important for any community anywhere in the world to affirm and live by civilized standards than to bow to the demands of the numerical majority. That is, much like Russell Kirk wrote in 1953 when he talked about the necessity of orders and classes and the appearance of democracy, but essentially a ruling elite. That is the conservative worldview, is it not?
Yes, it is. And on the next page of Constant the Liberal, I quote National Review from the same year, talking about what a great guy Francisco Franco was, having saved Spain from a regime that was betraying its soul, the regime happening to be the democratically elected government. So they're both the authoritarian streak and the pretty clear use of racism, all of that goes right back to the beginning. You know, we reinvent William F. Buckley as this kind of nice, fun guy in a bow tie. And the reality is that from the beginning, it's been a really harsh, what you see now is, if anything, a toned-down version of how it all started.
Yeah, well, if you strip the racism out, this language isn't all that different from what Alexander Hamilton was saying and what John Adams were saying at the founding of this country.
Oh, I don't think that's right. I mean, they were concerned. They wanted some slowing down of the process through representative democracy rather than pure democracy.
But they didn't want the Senate to be directly elected.
Yeah, well, you know.
They didn't trust the people.
The point of the matter is, that, of course, the really crucial thing is to see that what you've got is that today's conservative movement, which now talks a lot about democracy and freedom, when they were franker, when they weren't as good at, I use this phrase I love from the British, dog whistle politics, stuff that only certain people can hear, there was a clear anti-democratic streak in the movement and remains to this day.
Yeah, and they speak in code. You talk about how Lyndon Johnson basically blew it for the Democrats in the South by signing the Civil Rights Act, and the Republicans said, hey, a bunch of white Southern racists, we'll take them.
Yeah, one of the real revelations I found in doing Conscience of a Liberal, I didn't know this before I started doing the research, is once you take account of the Great Southern Switch, the white Southerners swinging to the Republicans after the Civil Rights Movement, there's not much left to explain if you're trying to understand why right-wing politics have prevailed in this country. A stunning statistic we all know white men have left the Democrats because of gods, guns, gays, whatever. It's not true if you take the South out of the picture. In 1952, 40% of non-Southern white men voted Democratic. In 2004, 39%. It's all the Great Southern Switch.
Yeah, so Richard Nixon's Southern strategy is still echoing with us. And in a very real way, the sense I get from your book is that George W. Bush is simply Nixon, and in particular Reagan, following the same trajectory. He's not an aberration.
That's right. Nixon pioneered the tactics. Nixon pioneered the Southern strategy, the smear tactics, and never forget that Roger Ailes of Fox News was Nixon's media guru. But Nixon wasn't actually an ideologue. If he believed in anything, it was just that he should be running things. But Reagan was, and there is no George W. Bush is Reagan's natural son. There really is not a. Now the conservatives say, oh, he wasn't a true conservative, he betrayed. This is not true. He's exactly what the movement was aiming for all along, and his failures are the movement's failures.
Yeah, indeed. We're having an in-depth conversation with Paul Krugman. He has a new book out. It's called The Conscience of a Liberal. His blog over at the New York Times, krugman.blog.nytimes.com. And he's a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University and et cetera. Boy, your credentials are an arm long. We will continue the conversation right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. Want to drop by our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com, our blog, airamerica.com. Stick around.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Paul Krugman, our guest, in one of our rare in-depth. Let's have a real conversation here with somebody who I have tremendous respect for, Paul Krugman, The Conscience of a Liberal, his new book, krugman.blogs.nytimes.com, his blog. Paul, you in your book you discuss, or Professor Krugman.
That's all right. I'm as long as you don't call me doctor and expect me to treat your headache. Okay.
All right. In your book, you talk about the difference between a liberal and a progressive being a belief system versus activism. You want to riff on that for a second?
Yeah, because, you know, some people avoid the word liberal because it's been trashed. And so ask people, are you a liberal? And most people say no. Ask them, do you believe that the government should guarantee health care to every American? And they say yes. So there's a real I think you can't run away from the label, but I think there is a real distinction between being a liberal, which is believing in democracy broadly defined, including economic democracy, and being a progressive, which is about action, so about trying to bring your beliefs into reality. So we have one of the great things. This is a very optimistic book, by the way. Conscience of a Liberal ends up so upbeat that my friends are asking me if I'm feeling all right. And one of the things that makes me so upbeat is that we have a real now a progressive movement in this country in a way we didn't a decade ago. And
yeah.
And it's clear it's a progressive movement. It's not a liberal movement. The progressive is the right term because it is people who are trying to make progress. They're trying to get stuff to happen. So it's an important distinction. I'd like to consider myself both both believing in these things and trying to make them happen. And progress. We are, the hope is that we're about to enter a new progressive era, maybe a new deal coming from these progressives, liberals who try to make, not just have a view, but make it a reality, changing America for the better.
Yeah, there are some echoes, I think, of the progressive movement from the 1880s to, well, up until the 1920s, the late 20s.
I quote Grover Norquist, the man we all love to quote because somebody said he's like a James Bond villain who likes to explain his evil plans. And
yes.
he once said he wanted to bring America back to the way it was before Teddy Roosevelt and the socialists came in. In other words, not just before the New Deal, but before the progressive movement. And, we're gonna frustrate him. He's not gonna get his way.
Well, America's waking up. There's one area where you and I have a stark contrast in our worldviews, and I'd like to explore that with you a little bit. And maybe you can bring me around or vice versa, or maybe we'll just agree to disagree. And that has to do with international trade. We have in the United States now, just this summer, 20 million Chinese-made toys were rejected because of lead paint and other lead hazards. That's mind-boggling. You point out that if we were to go back to, quote, protectionist tariff-type programs like China has right now, like Japan uses, like Korea uses, like most countries in the world actually use to greater or lesser extent, if we were to go back to that, it would really only whack our GDP by about a tenth of a percent. It wouldn't be that big a deal, but it would render or impoverish people in other countries because they wouldn't be doing our manufacturing. Don't we have as our first obligation building our middle class here?
The way I put it, first of all, I certainly have more pro-globalist views than a lot of people in the progressive movement, but I think there's been some toning down of the rhetoric on both sides of that internal debate. I once actually talked with Eric Alterman at a public event, and we agreed. I don't know who came up with it, but while we were arguing about the details of international trade policy, Sauron was gathering his forces in Mordor, and that's a little more important. So look, the way I would put it is this: first of all, product safety. Inspecting products, that's without question. That needs to be done. And other advanced countries do a much better job of that than we do. So this business of, failing to do any, require effective safety inspection of Chinese imports. No, that's not about free trade.
But if we
that's
just manufacture them here.
Right? The running joke right now is that actually we've now got a balanced trade with China. They send us poison toys, we send them fraudulent securities. So it's, the way I would put it is this. It's very, very important for the world's poorest. It's very important for the Bangladeshis of the world to be able to have access to world markets. On our side, most of what's going wrong is not because of globalization. Think about the fact that Sweden, France, Canada all face the same global market we do, but they don't have the same return of a Gilded Age that we do.
It's perfectly possible to have a strong welfare state, to have strong guarantees for workers, to have universal health care without shutting off imports of products.
Have we just lost Paul Krugman? Chris, I can't hear anything. I've just lost my... Oh, okay. Okay, well, apparently we've just lost Paul Krugman. We're going to try and get it back here, find out what happened. Apparently the phone line dropped. Anyhow, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Let's just take a phone call here or two until we get Paul back. Doug in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just want to say you're an inspiration to all of us there.
Thank you.
I have been listening to this whole thing about waterboarding, and I really, you know, it seems like the Republicans have done this huge political procedure with their rhetoric and these very visual images they come up with. And I think we should call it simulated drowning.
Well, that's exactly what it is. And it's not even simulated. It actually is drowning that is stopped, intentionally stopped, just before the person dies.
Well,
and,
you know,
because if you keep on doing it, they will die.
Right, and waterboarding just sounds like such a benign thing, like snowboarding or surfboarding or
no,
something like that.
No, it's slow, gradual drowning.
The image of simulated drowning or, you know, potential is just much more vivid to me. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, and yesterday we had on Fox News, and I mean, I'm pretty sure it was Fox News, talking about, you know, swimming lessons. This is just swimming lessons. It's nuts.
Right.
You know, Doug, thank you very much. And apparently Paul Krugman is back with us. You were saying, sir.
Oh gosh, yeah. Sorry, I guess
Alberto Gonzalez.
Department of Homeland Security, I guess, decided
exactly
to cut us off. That Heimatsicherheitsamtleitung, I think, is the correct phrase. Anyway, protection. Look, I think the answer is let's talk about it. I mean, I'm not going to go hard line. I look at somebody like Sherrod Brown in Ohio, who is a lot more protectionist than I am, but shares my values, shares my view about where things ought to be going, and I'm not going to be hard on him over this. Realistically, we're not going to shut off imports from the third world. We're certainly going to have more safety standards. It's an issue that needs to be discussed, but look, it's not top of the line either way.
Yeah. Okay. In that case, then we can't get into a shouty mash about it. Doggone it. Okay. Weapons of Mass Distraction.
Yeah.
A chapter in your book. This is marvelous, and it's how movement conservatism is talking in code. You want to riff on that for a minute or two?
Well, sure. There's a whole bunch. I mean, religious stuff. You know, the religious right is less important to Republican victory than it thinks, and they're finding some of their limits of their power right now. But it certainly has been a factor. And, you know, compassionate conservatism. What Bush was saying, people thought he was saying, I'm not going to hurt poor people. He wasn't saying that at all. He was actually referring to the work of Christian right authors like Marvin Alasky, the author of The Tragedy of Compassion, who basically said the poor should have to rely on faith-based aid from religious organizations that checks out their virtue before it gives them money. It was actually the opposite of what people thought Bush was saying. He was not saying we need to take care of the poor. He was saying actually we need to. Compassion means requiring them to, be good, the deserving poor, before they get money. And deserving poor means showing that they're sufficiently Christian. So there's
sort of a tough love mentality.
Very tough love and tough religious love in particular. Mm-hmm. And just in general, you know, the rightward turn of the Republican Party has never won elections on the basis of its economic policies, even though that's what they're interested in. They win elections by changing the subject. Bush wins in 2004 by being the nation's defender against gay married terrorists.
Yeah,
and only after the election does he say that what I really want to do is privatize Social Security.
Right, if in fact he won. I mean, you know.
There's a real issue there, but it's let's put it that way. He got a lot of people to vote for him because they thought he was, you know, moral values and national security, but what he was really interested in was undoing the New Deal.
What's your take on the current field of Democratic candidates as an economist, as a liberal?
On the policy side, it's very, very good. I mean, you got to look at the policy proposals, healthcare and otherwise, are more progressive than I would have imagined possible 2 years ago. The level of discussion is incredibly high. You watch those Democratic debates, and you've got a bunch of smart, well-informed people actually talking about issues. I worry about
the influence of the people who are giving money. You look at the fact that the that corporate giving has, with basically every industry except oil and gas, is now swung Democratic for this election cycle. That's good in terms of how the election is likely to turn out. It's dubious in terms of, you know, what will happen afterwards. And we have to hope that whoever is the Democratic nominee isn't actually going to be just, you know, Republican light. As I wrote in the column a few weeks back, we hope we're about to elect FDR. We're afraid we might be about to elect Grover Cleveland.
Right. You want to name names here?
Well, look, this is not a problem for John Edwards because he's not getting very much corporate money. Right. Hillary is.
Yeah, yeah. That's been my observation as well. Paul Krugman is the author of the book, The Conscience of a Liberal. Get out there and buy this book. It is absolutely extraordinary. And read his columns, of course, in the New York Times. Dr. Paul Krugman, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, 866-303-2270. Back with your calls.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
If you had your way, what would this country look like?
New York City during the Republican National Convention. In fact, that's what I think heaven's going to look like.
And what did that look like?
People were happy. They're Christians.
So it would be better if we were all Christian?
Yes.
We should just throw Judaism away. We should all be Christians.
Yeah. We just want Jews to be perfected.
When I was growing up, I was very insecure. Didn't know where I fit into this world. As I grew older, I found my place. And finally my nose grew into my face. Then I saw Ann Coulter on the TV screen. She said, if you want to be perfect, you should be just like me. Mom says she's a whore. Dad said she's soft for attention. She's got the hottest Adam's apple at the Republican convention.
We just want Jews to be perfected.
Perfect me. Make me petty. I want to be hateful like Ann Coulter. Convert me to Christianity. I want to be perfected.
We could take care of Iran so that they couldn't build a transistor radio.
Just like Ann Coulter.
I was going to have a few comments on the other Democratic presidential candidate, John Edwards, but it turns out that you have to go into rehab if you use the word faggot.
I know I'm just a Jew, but we could be best friends forever. Want to come over later and watch Seinfeld together? You could teach me to hate liberals, the New York Times, and what they say. We could prank call John Edwards and tell him he's gay.
Faggot.
I would do anything to be just like you.
Oh, man. I'm telling you. Ann Coulter is no Christian. I mean, let me be on record, in my opinion. 51 minutes past the hour. A Pacific Rubbish Superhighway. This is a vast rubbish dump which covers an area larger than Australia, bigger than Texas, for those who've never seen Australia on a map. It's floating in the Pacific Ocean, and research shows it's growing bigger. This is from the Australian News Service, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, abc.au. What's in this continent-sized island? Toothbrushes are quite common, plastic bags, soap bottles. We're finding a good many umbrella handles, minus the umbrella, fine toolboxes. Oddly enough, plastic hard hats. This rubbish patch is extremely remote. It takes a week to reach it in a boat. This is where the current flows in one direction and the winds go in the other, and it's created this giant whirlpool, as it were, in the middle of the Pacific, and now a pile of trash bigger than a continent. Mind-boggling. Our Jaws alert for the day. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Josh, Nashville, North Carolina. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Hey, so glad to finally talk to you. Listen, I was really hoping that we can start to begin to define the Republicans of the last 8 years by a new phrase, and that phrase is by any means necessary. When I think about what they've been doing, whether it's in national security, whether it's in, international trade, whether it's in pretty much anything, the means by which they want to do it, does not matter, and it has not mattered. And for me, I think that that's pretty un-American. And I think it's time that we point it out. We say, look, this is not what America is about. And if you're willing to vote for someone who will accomplish these goals, look, I think that a stable Middle East is a viable and a practical goal. I think that a secure energy, you know, sort of, you know, a secure energy policy is something that we should do, but it's not by any means necessary. And that's never been the history of America. It's not what Americans want.
Yeah.
So I'm just hoping that you will jump on the bandwagon and of that phrase and really start to paint these Republicans as that.
By any means necessary Republicans. That's a good one, Josh. Thank you very much. And I agree with you that the Republican Party has become absolutely Machiavellian and absolutely, you know, they're so out of the mainstream. Parvez in Larchmont, New York.
Hi, Tom. Nice talking to you, and thank you for the good program. My hypothesis is that if President Carter had gotten reelected, we would not have had 9/11, we would not have had two Iraq wars, we would not be in the mess that we are in now. And I'll tell you why. You know, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, he did not get Osama bin Laden to go over there and fight them. He boycotted them, boycotted the Olympics.
Right.
And then he would not have told Saddam Hussein to invade Kuwait, so that he could put our troops in Saudi Arabia. He would not have agreed with the Israelis to invade Lebanon and cooperated with them, and 240 of our best men were killed because of Reagan and Bush policies. So the Reagan and two Bushes have brought disaster to us. So
yeah, and
really
plus they rolled back. Plus they rolled back the New Deal. I mean, economically, the economic policies, they declared war on the middle class. They declared war on our labor unions. And Jimmy Carter also had started a solar program. He had said, never again will we import more oil than we did in 1978, and that by the year 2000, 20% of our electricity would come from solar power.
Yeah.
And if we had kept into place those policies that he put into place that Reagan repealed, we would now not be fighting oil wars in the Middle East, because we would probably be energy independent.
And neoliberalism, you know, they started neoliberalism, Reagan.
Yeah, that's my point, rolling back the New Deal.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
that is a disaster, you know, for the third world countries, because what they do, they're economic hitmen. They go over there and say, well, this is a nice project for you, and we give you money to do it, but they give them a lot of money. They know that the things will... project.
Yep.
So when they cannot pay... they cannot pay, the IMF goes and say, okay, we're going to loan you some money, but you have to vote for us in the United Nations, and you have to tighten your belt.
No, you're absolutely right, Parvez. And John Perkins and Naomi Klein outline it beautifully in their books, Confessions of an Economic Hitman and Disaster Capitalism, Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. I talk about it in my book, Screwed. You're absolutely right. And it's all about rolling back the New Deal. I mean, you know, that's the bottom line.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
As, you know, Mr. Oxycontin likes to say, and it's true, they are. They're all about doing something about rolling back the New Deal, about ending the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, about bringing us back to the Gilded Age, and, you know, it's certainly the direction we're moving. And hopefully this election will signal the turn. You know, this is what Paul Krugman is so optimistic about. I'm frankly very optimistic about it, because the American people have had enough. The American people are waking up, and there is a strong and growing progressive movement in the United States. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, let's talk politics for a while here. What's going on with this whole... I am boggled that any of the candidates... Well, actually, even beyond the candidates, that the media in this country is going after Hillary Clinton for mentioning the fact that she's female. I mean, these were the right-wing talking points. It's amazing how the right-wing talking points get picked up. A couple of weeks ago, the right-wing talking points, all the right-wing talk shows were talking about how there was a story, an unflattering story about John Edwards in the National Enquirer. And all the right-wingers went off on it, you know, for hours at a time. And you know, I'm not going to go near that kind of nonsense.
And now all the right-wingers are going off on this thing about, oh, Hillary's just, she's just trying to get sympathy because she's a woman. I don't see that. I don't hear that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, frankly, I think this country is ready for a woman as president of the United States. We have more women in the Senate and the House than ever before, and I think it's been a good thing for this country. Some countries have, you know, have minimum thresholds. I believe Norway, Sweden, and Iceland have minimum thresholds of the number of women who have to be in parliament, and there may be others. There may be other countries as well. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that for the United States, but and as you know, those of you who are regular listeners to this program, Hillary Clinton is not my favorite of the candidates, but the fact that she's a woman, I mean, A, so what? And B, well, actually, maybe it's a good thing. Yes, you can bring out the Maggie Thatcher analogy, and being female certainly is no guarantee of perfection or anything like that. But just going after somebody and saying, as the media seems to be doing and as all the right-wingers are doing, that Clinton is playing the gender card. I mean, come on, give me a break. She is a woman. She has every right to point it out and say so, and to appeal to women voters. I have no problem with that. The other thing that boggles my mind is that Tim Russert, during the debate, asked a total of 30 questions. Media Matters for America did a great job of breaking this out. You can see it over at MediaMatters.org. He asked 30 questions of the candidates. 14 of those 30 questions were either directed to or were about Hillary Clinton. And so when she says, you know, I'm being ganged up on, you know, there's the guys are out to get me, whatever, or, you know, she didn't use that phrase, but out to get me, but, you know, the guys, she's right. She's absolutely right. And I think that what's going on here is that the big mainstream media, which Tim Russert certainly is, you know, one of the most visible faces of, the big mainstream media would prefer, thank you very much, to have a horse race. They would prefer to have a really, really tight race right up until the end. Why? Because it drives viewership of their programming, particularly their political programming. If everybody assumes right now that any one candidate, whether it's Hillary or Barack Obama or John Edwards or Dennis Kucinich or Chris Dodd or anybody, if everybody were to assume, oh, it's in the bag. So we saw the same thing with Howard Dean 4 years ago. If everybody were to assume, oh, it's in the bag, then, you know, it's not interesting television anymore. And if it's not interesting television, then you don't get the ratings, you don't get the ratings, you don't make the money, and ultimately that's what it's all about in infotainment television, is the ratings. Now, you know, I'm not saying that to be entirely critical, because this is infotainment radio, and we're all about the ratings, and we're getting very good ratings, by the way, thank you very much. But the point is that the news is because our news now from these same networks is infotainment. The news keeps it's almost schizophrenic. They go into this, oh, Hillary is the front runner. It's absolute. She's got this thing locked up. There's no doubt about it. It's all. And then, oh, let's beat her up a whole bunch and see if we can take her down a notch, because, you know, we can't have a clear front runner, because if you have a clear front runner, then you've got a boring race. You got a boring race, you don't have the ratings. Now, all that said, the issue that they went after her on is whether or not people who are in this country without documentation, people who are in this country quite literally illegally, should have access to driver's licenses. And I've received a number of emails on this, because my position is that people who are in this country illegally should not be in this country illegally. You know, pretty much end of discussion. I am entirely in favor of dramatic and substantial overhaul of our immigration laws. I am intimately familiar with our immigration policies. As an employer, back in 1988, I had to go through the process of getting an H-1B visa for an employee. Back then, you actually had to prove that you really desperately needed somebody and you couldn't find an American to fill the job. I was the CEO of an ad agency. I also owned the majority of the stock in it, and in Atlanta, Georgia. And we had a client that was producing a newsletter. It was a multinational company, and they were producing a newsletter in Japanese, English, and Spanish. And I needed somebody who was a graphic designer, somebody who could work in Quark, which was the program that we were using at the time on our Macs. They probably still are. I don't know. We sold the ad agency in the mid-90s. But it was a graphic designer and could use the software in the program and was sufficiently fluent in English, Japanese, and Spanish that they could proofread copy. And if I could find that one person, it would save me having to hire basically three or four different people to coordinate this thing for this one client, and we wouldn't have been able to, you know, do it at an economical price for the client. And we ran an ad, and this fellow applied for the job. His first name was Shinji, we called him. And he was born in Japan, moved to Peru with his family when he was about 10 years old, and learned Spanish in Peru, and then moved with his family to the United States when he was around 16, and all that time he had been learning English, and he spoke absolutely fluent English, absolutely fluent Spanish, and absolutely fluent Japanese. I don't know, maybe he'd been 6 or 7 when he moved to Peru. But in any case, he spoke all three languages, and he had a 4-year degree from a college as a graphic artist. I had to go through all these hoops. I mean, it took 3 months to hire this guy. I had to run ads in the paper to prove that I couldn't find an American to do the job. I had to go down to INS. I had to fill out sworn statements. So I'm telling you, I have some familiarity, not to mention the fact that my wife's brother is married to somebody who was born in another country. It is in the process now. She's now 4 years into the process of obtaining citizenship in the United States. And Louise and I have had to go through the whole thing of saying to the INS, yes, you know, Art and his wife really are in love with each other. No, it's not a sham marriage. Yes, we do know, you know. Yeah, I'm familiar with how it works. And I'm telling you, our immigration system is a mess and our immigration systems are broken. But that said, the way to solve it is not to simply say, okay, anybody in this country, now you're legal. Here, have a driver's license. That's nuts. That's nuts. Now, I get an email from somebody who says, okay, consider, if you provide driver's licenses to people who can't prove that they're in this country legally, you do two things. One, you provide some assurance that people can read traffic signs, abide by traffic rules, and generally be safe on the road. Two, you allow those people to get auto insurance. Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, if they're here and they're going to drive, let's make sure that they're driving safely. A car, arguably, is as much of a deadly weapon as, I mean, it's, a, you know, 6,000 pounds going 70 miles an hour. That's a major deadly weapon. Let's just legalize the possession of surface-to-air missiles and sell them at Walmart, because that way we can at least know who's buying them, and the sales clerks will have an opportunity to tell the person buying the surface-to-air missile that they shouldn't shoot them at commercial aircraft. How about that? I mean, that's how much sense, in my opinion, this makes. It's like, let's just, because something is going on that shouldn't be going on, let's just decriminalize it so that we can keep an eye on it. Now, you can make that argument for some things, you know, like smoking pot or selling it or whatever. But in terms of number one, you know, surface-to-air missiles, or number two, driver's licenses for illegal aliens, I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. I just don't buy it. We're going to do a quick presidential straw poll here right now. I'm going to ask Lauren to just go through and clear all our lines very quickly. I apologize to the folks who've been on hold. You'll have an opportunity to call back at the bottom of the hour. We're going to come back and for the last half of the show just be taking your calls. But during right after this break, we're going to have a segment that's going to run about 10 minutes. And during that time, I'm going to ask people to just call in 866-303-2270 and just say the person that you would vote for president. You will hear the phone ring and ring and ring and ring until I put you on the air. You'll hear a and you'll be on the air and I'll say, who would you vote for? And just say who you would vote for. And then I'm going to move on to the next person. And David is going to keep track. But we're going to do the presidential straw poll here on the Tom Hartman program. If you're on hold, please hang up and call back. At the bottom of the hour, we'll be taking calls for the last half hour of the show. 16 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman program. We're about to start the presidential straw poll. Again, you will simply hear it ring and ring and ring and ring until we put you on the air. Don't expect it to be answered until then. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Okay, 21 minutes past the hour. We're going to do our presidential straw poll here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Call 1-866-303-2270. You will hear it ring and ring and ring until I pop you on the air, then just tell us who you're voting for. David will mark it down, and we'll give you the tally at the end. And I'm seeing callers from area codes all over the country. Here we go. Who would you vote for today? You are on the air.
Okay.
Who would you vote for?
John Edwards.
Okay, John Edwards. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, who would you vote for today?
Kucinich self-destructed, so I'd vote for John Edwards.
Okay, John Edwards. I'll start calling out the area codes so people will know that they're on the air. 212, who would you vote for today?
Edwards.
Okay, 828, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, 708, who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, 206, who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, 619, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 703, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, 323, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, 858, who would you vote for if the Democratic primary were today?
Chris Dodd.
Chris Dodd, thank you very much. 425, who would you vote for today if it was held today?
John Edwards.
Okay, blocked number. I don't know. Who would you vote for today if it was today?
Kucinich.
Okay, thank you. 612, who would you vote for if it was today?
John Edwards.
303, who would you vote for if it was today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 949, who would you vote for if it was today?
Edwards.
Okay, unknown area code. Who would you vote for? That one just vanished. 541, who would you vote for if it was held today?
Hillary Clinton.
Okay, thank you. 508, who would you vote for if the Democratic primary were today?
Barack Obama.
Okay, 206, your vote.
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. 646, your vote.
Hi.
Who would you vote
John
for?
John Edwards.
Thank you very much. Unknown number, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 248, who would you vote for if the election were held today? Kucinich. Kucinich, the primary today. Thank you. Our number, 866-303-2270. 559, who would you vote for if the election were held today?
Edwards.
Thank you. 201, who would you vote for if the election were today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Unknown. That one just vanished. 360. Who would you vote for if the election were today?
Edwards.
Thank you. 720. Who would you vote for if it were today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 813. Your vote?
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama. Thank you. 734. Your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. 425 area code. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 303 area code. Who would you vote for today? You're on the air? Okay, you got to be listening to your phone, not your radio. Sorry. Unknown. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Another blocked call. Unknown. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you very much. 206 area code. Who would you vote for today?
I would vote for Edwards.
Thank you. 970. Who would you vote for if the election were today?
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama. Thank you. 805. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, thank you. 410. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 503, your vote today.
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 626, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 951, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 623, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 845, who would you vote for today?
Obama.
Thank you very much. Area code 42, another 425, who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area 505, who would you vote for today?
Kucinich.
Unknown. Who would you vote for today? Whoop. Sorry about that. Unknown. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 510. Who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. 253. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 603. Your vote today. 603?
603.
That's you. Who would you vote for?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. 864. Who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 216. Who would you vote for?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 267. Your vote?
Kucinich.
Thank you. Unknown area code. Your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 510. Who would you vote for?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area 646. Your vote?
Kucinich.
Thank you. Area 480. Your vote?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Unknown. Your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Unknown. Your vote today?
John Edwards.
Okay, thank you. Unknown, your vote today?
Yes.
Yes?
Kucinich.
Oh, Kucinich. Okay, thank you. voting yes is always a good idea. But 516, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 201, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 575, your vote today?
Can I say Al Gore?
You certainly can, and you just did. 704, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 310, your vote today?
Hello?
Yeah, your vote?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. 417, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 586, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 510, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 425, your vote today?
Hi, Tom Kucinich.
Thank you. 562, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 720, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. 413, your vote today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. 310, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. 360, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 412, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 732, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. 303, your vote today?
Bill Richardson.
Okay, and that wraps it up. We'll give you the tally right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Fire it up. Fire it up. We push off. We are rolling boulders, crashing down the mirrored stairways to a blast best mountaineers. Fire it up. Fire
34
it
minutes
up.
Past the hour. Just a heads up, Cracking the Code, my new book, is available at a 35% discount over at Powell's, both Powell's bookstores and Powell's online, powells.com. And I'll be doing a rant and a book signing at Powell's bookstore in Portland and Burnside next Monday night at 7:30 for those listening in Portland, Oregon. And coming up also, we'll be doing the same on Saturday in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, and on Friday, week from Friday, in Phoenix. And I'll give you the details on that in 15 minutes. Here is the result of our straw poll, our presidential straw poll here on the Tom Hartman Program. John Edwards won with 41 votes. Dennis Kucinich came in second with 21 votes. Barack Obama came in third with 7 votes. And there was a tie among the among Hillary Clinton, Chris Dodd, Bill Richardson, and Al Gore, who each received 1 vote. So 41 for Edwards, 21 for Kucinich, 7 for Obama, and everybody else got 1 vote, except for Mike Gravel and Joe Biden, who got 0. So that's how it broke up. Interesting. Interesting. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how this thing all breaks out, how it all shakes out as time goes on. Laura in Austin, in New York. Hey, Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering whether you think it's possible that Al Gore's confusing behavior could be explained if you assume that Senator Clinton has promised him an energy czar position in her administration. And, of course, the problem with that would be how much real decision-making power would he have? Would he find himself shilling for policies that were slow on alternatives and heavy on nuclear?
Yeah, my sense of it, and I base this on two things. One, having watched him ever since, and the other, about a year and a half ago, he came here to Portland and did his 11th hour, his Inconvenient Truth thing at our sports arena. You know, it's like 5,000 people showed up. And I introduced him. I spent some time with him beforehand, and I moderated a Q&A for about an hour afterwards. No recording devices were allowed. And the issue of his running for president came up. And I was standing 3 feet away from him, you know. And it just was so clear to me that he had not just no interest in that, but that he was
uncomfortable. Just felt it was distasteful.
He looked like somebody in pain, in physical pain, just thinking about it.
Yeah, and he wants to be energy czar. He doesn't want to be president.
Yeah, I'm not even sure he wants to be energy czar. I think that he is in a position right now where he can, as an influencer outside the system, have more power than somebody within the system, and I think that that's probably where he wants to stay. But I certainly can't speak for Al Gore, and other than that one occasion, I've only met him once, and I can't say that I know him or know how he thinks. But that would be my take on it. But well, you know, time will tell. Laura, thank you very much for the call, and let's not forget, by the way, the Republicans. I mean, we're going into the Democratic primary. Jim Turr, by the way, sends me a note. He says your surface-to-air missile analogy with driver's licenses is imperfect. Okay, let's just say concealed weapons. Anybody ought to be able to walk into any store anywhere and simply buy, you know, a small handheld machine gun, right? Because then you'll have an opportunity to make sure that they know how to use it. Again, if it's not right, if it's not legal, then you don't just do it because, hey, they're here with regard to driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. But back to the point of don't forget the power of the conservatives in choosing who it is they want to run against. In Iowa, 4 years ago, the conservatives did not want George W. Bush to have to run against Howard Dean, because they knew that Howard Dean would absolutely kick George Bush's butt straight on down the street and out of Pennsylvania Avenue, and he would have. And so the only candidate that the Club for Growth PAC spent any money on, and they spent $1 million in one state, $1 million in Iowa, to run this ad. It's a TV ad. Here's the audio of it, 30 seconds. Whoops. Supposed to play.
What do you think of Howard Dean's plans to raise taxes on families by $1,900 a year?
What do I think? Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking, sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading,
body piercing, Hollywood loving, left wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs.
Got it?
Club for Growth PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And guess what? They got the Republicans, in my opinion, got what they wanted. They got to run against John Kerry. Or at least they didn't have to run against Howard Dean. And I think that that's what they were afraid of. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all shakes out, and how much the Republicans get involved in the Democratic primary. Just like, again, Ed Muskie would have easily beaten Richard Nixon. And so he sends his goon squad off to New Hampshire to sabotage Ed Muskie, steal his letterhead, make a racist remark in a letter over his signature. It gets published in the Manchester Union Leader. Some are alleging that drugs were put in his coffee. He gets up on the back of a flatbed truck and starts crying, talking about his wife, and boom, Ed Muskie's toast. And Richard Nixon is safe because he's now running against somebody that he knows, according to the polls, he knows he can beat. Tom in San Diego, California. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, I wanted to talk to you about polling in general. We received a phone call wanting to know about who we were voting for in the primaries. And my wife tells him, Kucinich. And said, oh, great, so I can put you down for Hillary Clinton. No, Kucinich. So you're really saying you support Hillary Clinton, right? And this went back and forth five or six times before my wife finally went, this is ridiculous, hung up.
Did they identify themselves as who the polling agency was?
It was one of the major ones. She doesn't remember exactly which one.
Yeah, because I suspect that was not a polling agency, you know. And, you know, but why, who would do that and why, I don't get it. Because it sounds sort of like a push poll, you know, like what happened to John McCain in South Carolina, where people called up registered Republicans and said, you know, who would you vote for? And if people said John McCain, then they said, would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain had been taking psychiatric medication and had been treated psychiatrically for post-traumatic stress disorder as a consequence of his having been a prisoner of war in Vietnam? And people say either yes or no. And then they say, would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain had fathered an out-of-wedlock child with an African-American woman, and that's why he and his wife have a dark-skinned daughter? And people would say yes or no. And then they say, would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain's wife had been treated for depression and was under psychiatric care and observation? And people would say whatever they'd say. And then they say, thank you very much, and hang up. Now, none of those things were true. They said that, but they phrased them that way. This was Karl Rove. But this was the Bush campaign doing this, because McCain had just beaten Bush in New Hampshire. And if he also beat him in South Carolina, it would have been all over for George Bush. And that's how George Bush won the Republican nomination, was by taking down McCain in South Carolina. And it sounds to me like in San Diego, Tom, there you were the recipient of some kind of a push poll that might have been designed to make Hillary Clinton look bad. I don't know. You know, maybe Republicans going after Hillary Clinton.
They didn't go any further like some of the questions you stated. Just everything went no matter what you answered. Oh, well, you mean Hillary Clinton then?
Yeah.
And I almost wonder if, like, the Republicans wouldn't rather run against Hillary, because even if worst case for them they lose, Hillary winds up president, she's available out there.
Yeah, and I think that they think that she's more easily beaten because of the baggage of being a Clinton. There's
right.
no doubt in my mind that the Republicans would rather have Hillary on as the Democratic nominee for a variety of reasons.
Scared of Kucinich and Edwards.
Yeah, but this sounds like it wasn't something designed to promote Hillary. This sounds like it was something designed to hurt her. That's very interesting. Tom, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. And if anybody else had a similar experience, I'd love to hear about it. 1-866-303-2270. Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Bernice.
Hi, Tom. You know, you are just so thoughtful about so many issues. You're very humane. But when it comes to the issue of undocumented immigrants, I get such a different sense from you, and it really is disturbing to me. And I just, you know, I have to ask you, do you know any undocumented immigrants? Do you know
any
children who are undocumented immigrants? Because, you know, they did not have a choice to get into this country, to come here. Their parents brought them, and any more than where you grew up. You know, I grew up where my parents had me, and so did these children and their children. And the parents came here, you know, in great hopes that this was a land of opportunity. Most of the time that doesn't work out so great for them, at least for a generation or two. But, you know, there's just so much involved in this, and I just don't think that people always look at the humanity and that these are human beings. It's not one blanket statement.
Bernice, I'm on the record as saying that I think that anybody in this country should have access to universal health care. I think anybody in this country mm-hmm. should have access to education. I see this as an illegal employer problem, not an illegal
right.
individual problem.
Uh-huh.
We are the right has turned this into a mantra vilifying the individuals. I'm opposed to that. I think that there's a heavy racist undertone to it. That said, I lived in another country for a year. I had to go through the process of getting a work permit.
But
a good
Tom,
friend
how much
of mine,
money?
Neil Donald Walsh, just a couple of weeks ago showed up in England to give a speech, and they wouldn't let him out of his hotel because his secretary had forgotten to fill out the paperwork to get a work permit. Every country in the world says if you're going to come in and dilute our labor pool and drive down the cost of labor, you have to fill out the paperwork. And for us to say that we're going to wipe out our middle class or in exchange for just...
But it's not
you know,
the people that are... That it's not.
No,
people
it's not the people. I agree. With you
but who ends up being victimized? You know, it's the children
and the society. And if and that's why I say it's we have an illegal employer problem. If we started putting employers in jail, we would not have to deal at the level of the individuals because
well,
individuals
right,
would say, "I'm going to go back to Mexico and become an activist and vote for progressive legislation in Mexico." Bernice, thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Kalo, Chris Lopresto, and Lauren Kirshner at Air America Radio, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, the sponsors on our local stations, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. And just one other quick heads up. I'm heading out this afternoon to Albuquerque, where I will be keynoting the Holistic Management International Conference tomorrow, the website holisticmanagement.org. And at 5 o'clock tomorrow, I'll be signing books at Hastings Books and Music in Albuquerque. Monday night, Powell's Bookstore here in Portland. And then a week from tonight in Phoenix, Arizona, at the Harkins Theater in Tempe. And for that, you do need tickets. You need to go to the website for KPHX, which is 1480kphx.com. And let me just, to the last caller, I'm sure that you're feeling that you were chopped off. When the music starts, we have hard breaks on this program all the way around. The music starts, and it just, you know, it's the end. And I realize you were coming back to what about the kids, and I agree. And that we need to have significant reform of our immigration policies, and we need to figure out what to do and how to help children in the United States, particularly children who are citizens of the United States, whose parents are not. I mean, there's a huge gray area that needs to be addressed. But at the same time, We have allowed into this into the United States, what, fewer than 6,000 or maybe it's fewer than 5,000 refugees from Iraq, where we've created a 4.5 million person refugee crisis, the largest refugee crisis in the world, perhaps the second largest behind Darfur. There are people who are literally escaping famine. You know, talk about children who are dying. And this country used to be the last great refuge, the last great hope. And instead we're saying, no, you can't come here because we'd rather have people come in from Mexico who will work for cheap at the local meat plant, packing plant. And in the meantime, displacing all the old union jobs that used to be there. I just don't think it's right. And I think that we need to have a rational way to go about it. I'm not, you know, one of these gung-ho right-wingers, put them all on a bus and ship them out of here. I really think that when you start putting the employers in jail, you will see people. You don't have to deport people. People will leave. Jim Tur sends me a note. He says, if people aren't allowed to drive, they can't work for the most part. So we come out into deporting millions of people? No. If you can't work, what do? You leave. I can tell you that, having been in countries where they wouldn't let me work. So Victoria Jones, who's actually, you're a citizen in Victoria, aren't you?
I certainly am. I took the test.
Yes, of the United States.
Unlike you.
Yeah, you're right. I was just born here.
Yes.
Oh, my. Although I'll tell you, when I wanted to get a work permit to live and work in Germany, I had to jump through so many hoops. And I had to prove to the German government that I had skills that they couldn't hire a German to do. Just like when I wanted to hire a I told that whole long story. I need not repeat it. Anyhow, what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, we've got all kinds of things going on. President Bush vetoed a bill today, not necessarily unusual. This is a water projects bill, the incredible intricate details of which I won't bore you with, mostly because I don't understand them. But it's a $23 billion bill. He objected to $9 billion worth of projects that were added during negotiations between the Senate and the House. What's interesting about this is that this passed both houses with more than enough votes to override the veto. This is likely to be the first successful override of the Bush presidency.
Yeah. Yeah. My guess, Victoria, is that this is the beginning of Bush trying to establish his legacy as the Barry Goldwater, or for that matter, the Lyndon Johnson. I mean, you know, with the war on poverty. The guy who stood for something. Whether, you know, right or wrong, he stood for something. And what he stands for, of course, is, you know, bringing back the aristocracy, screwing the middle class, all those things. But nonetheless, he's going to be philosophically consistent. I mean, back in 77, when he ran for Congress unsuccessfully, he failed from Texas for the U.S. House of Representatives. His main campaign platform was privatizing Social Security, doing away with federal Social Security. And he lost on it, but he's still trying to do that. So do you disagree?
I don't disagree at all.
Yeah, no, that's my sense of it, that he doesn't care if they override him or not. He's going to make his statements and take his stance.
He's going to make his statement. Yes, he's going to take a stand. And, of course, he is also saying, as he said to the Heritage Foundation yesterday, that he's not limping towards the finish line. He says, my spirits are high, my energy level is good, and I'm sprinting to the finish line, saying that he should put on his running shoes. So just watch out.
And
so
this is going to play well with
you.
Yeah, this is going to play well with the conservative base the same way that if Nancy Pelosi was to absolutely start giving the Republicans hell about the war in Iraq or to allow a debate on impeachment, it would energize the Democratic base.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. To me, the most interesting story is the quandary that Senator Schumer finds himself in over Judge Mukasey. What is he to do? Is he to oppose his nomination now, having introduced him and been a huge supporter, or is he to go ahead and still support him? This is quite a quandary for such an outspoken man, a man who under any other circumstances would by now already have said, I'm voting against Mukasey.
Right. And if you want to let Chuck Schumer or any other senator know your opinion, the toll-free numbers for Congress are over at callcongress.org on the web. And the main phone number, of course, is 202-225-3121. What else is going on?
Well, meantime, the CIA director, Michael Hayden, is reassuring Congress and the public that the agency only selectively uses its special methods of questioning in its interrogation programs. But he's also assuring us that these are the ones that bring about the big results, saying that of about 100 subjects, 9,000 intelligence reports have detailed critical elements of al-Qaeda. So basically, I guess waterboarding works is what he's telling us.
Right, just like the early days of the Nazi regime. They were using those techniques very selectively. Victoria, and I want to ask you to comment on that. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Coming up on Monday, Paul Kangor is going to be here. He's saying there's no candidate, none, as radical as Hillary Clinton. That should be interesting. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Have a great weekend. Tag, you're it. See you on Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.